Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be speaking to someone from the Interstellar Research Group. That's basically a collective of scientists, engineers and geeks who are trying to figure out how to get to the next solar system. Not just a planet, but the next solar system. And really, really interesting ideas and sort of sci-fi concepts put together to try and maybe figure out how we can get there. Really interesting stuff. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me in studio is Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU School of Chemical Sciences and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Shane, our first story is about everyone's favourite spacecraft, the Voyager.
Yeah, I kind of think at this stage NASA are doing it just because it's like, you know, it's old and it's cool, which, like you, Jonathan, is worth it, right? So it's 46 years since NASA launched Voyager 1, 1977. Imagine like Star Wars era, kind of the first Star Wars, the good Star Wars.
We knew nothing then.
No.
We barely knew what, like, gravity was a thing. Go on.
And this little machine was launched and it was sent out to look at Jupiter and Saturn, a five-year mission. But it really was, I suppose, going to go a lot further than that. And after the 5 years, it left our solar system and since then has been transmitting data back to Earth. It's powered by plutonium. It travels at 61,000 kilometers per hour and it is an incredible 24 billion kilometers away from the Earth. It's the only human-made object that's in interstellar space. And unfortunately, last December, it started sending back gibberish code. It's remarkable that it sends anything at all to anything. But what it was sending back was gibberish. One of the three computers on board started to go into a bit of a meltdown. Not surprising. The total memory on the Voyager 1 is 70 kilobytes, right? To put that in context, I reckon that's about 500 times less than a good photo on your phone. And it uses magnetic tape to store data and that's it.
It's right? The whole thing that it's still going is bonkers to me.
So the people in NASA, more specifically in the Jet Propulsion Lab, they decided they had a workaround. And so this story, if it were happening on Earth, would never get attention from anyone because it was just coders doing what they do best, which is working on a creative fix for something that had gone wrong in the hardware. And so they worked on a fix and they sent it to the Voyager probe and it took 22 hours to get there.
Traveling at the speed of light.
Yeah, and 22 hours for us to know whether it got there. In other words, it had to send something back. And just last Monday, it started to work again, right? And so it's still trundling along, going, as I said, at 61,000 kilometres an hour. And yeah, we hope long may it last, right?
Am I right in saying we've no idea where it is exactly? Like, we don't know the position of it?
No, we do. We do. We know the trajectory it's on. And so I was reading about it and Voyager 2 and where they may end up in tens of thousands of years.
Oh, right.
They may still go.
But whether or not it's still in this solar system is up for debate because it's sort of a grey area, right?
Yeah, where the solar system ends is like there isn't a sign that says you are now leaving the solar system. That'd be quite funny. But I think it's well understood.
Very Douglas Adams concept, isn't it? when you say you know where it's going to end up, like where will it end up?
Well, we know what direction it's going in, so right. We know what it'll go close to. And I think in a couple of tens of thousands of years, it's going to go pretty close to a star. So that might be the
end. That might be the end of that. Our second story, Susan, has to do with pandemics. And I kind of feel like I'm full. I kind of feel like I've had my fill of pandemics and don't need a new one. What's this story about?
I mean, it's fair to say that we are, you know, we were just over it and it was catastrophic and none of us, I think, maybe expected it to be a pandemic in terms of how global it was. We'd heard of endemics and, you know, you'd hear things throughout the years on the run-up to pandemics. But the reality is that pandemics are going to become far more normal, unfortunately, and we're going to have to plan. Yeah, we're going to have to plan a lot more about them. There's going to be more of them further up. Well, there is a lot more, I think, the idea of travel and the evolving nature of the viruses, it's just going to ramp up.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that we can't get on top of it. And the first thing is figuring out which one's coming next. So there was a survey basically sent out to international experts in this field, so in disease control. And they were asked what they thought was the most likely virus that would cause the next pandemic. Now, they can't suggest when it's going to be, when it's going to arrive. But the survey was carried out by Cologne University researchers. And basically, the study showed that 57% of the experts figure that a strain of the flu virus is going to be the thing that's going to cause the next pandemic. And then the next highest number was 21% of people thinking that it was a disease that we haven't even met yet, which is quite terrifying, in fact, in terms of being able to kind of, you know,
reverse engineer something,
deliver on a vaccine in order to prevent it. 15% think that SARS-CoV-2 isn't done with us yet, and that that might sort of become a global pandemic again. Now, the thing that they all have in common, of course, is that they're viruses. This is what I was saying, is that their replication cycle is just so fast, and that they can travel and survive so easily in the human host system and travel around, as we know, very often in the air. So viruses are certainly the things that are going to be the cause of the pandemic.
Right. They don't think like spores from mushrooms, like The Last of Us.
Exactly. And no bacterial elements at all. Ebola and Zika are not very high risk, they don't think. And I think that's just to do with perhaps they're very localized at the moment, and maybe they're not as stable when they're out in the environment. So that's kind of a good news if you're, you know, worried about, not if you're worried about Ebola, don't be. And then there's the rising increase of sort of avian flu that is then moving into cattle. That's the first time there's this H5N1 virus that is now in cattle for the first time. Mm. It's in 12 states and domesticated cattle in the US. So we humans don't we're not able to take on avian flus, but we can take on other mammalian flus. The fact that the avian flu, which is this H5N1, has gone from birds to cattle, it might come to us next. So that could be it, but...
This is great. This is just a great long list of things that people can worry about if they find that they're not worried about anything at the moment, that they're, you know, they just... gives them something to chew on. That's
science
fantastic.
Science always provides, Jonathan.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I mean, it is just a what do you think is going to happen? And often we just ignore that. If we look at climate change scientists, we ask them, what do you think is going to happen? The whole world is going to burn down. Okay, great. Thanks for that. I'll check in with you in a couple of months' time. So what's interesting, I suppose, for the next couple of years is that people will actually pay attention to people who talk about pandemics. Mm. And then we'll probably forget about it, and then we'll be caught surprised once more. Our third story, Shane, has to do with our perception of time.
Yeah, Einstein, to paraphrase him, said that an hour with a loved one seemed like an instant, whereas a couple of seconds in pain felt like an eternity. In other words, time is something that you perceive, right? You know,
it's relative.
It's relative, exactly. Yeah. So this is a paper that was published in New York in Nature, and it offers a fresh perspective on how we experience and keep track of time. Now, it's been known for a long time that if you show people complex images, screens with lots of things on it, the longer they're able to look at it, the more they'll be able to remember, right? What this paper is saying is that a person's sense of subjective experience of time can also have effect on how much you remember. What they did was they got these volunteers. I'm always curious as to where they find these people. I reckon they're almost always PhD students.
Yeah. Probably, yeah.
So, 252 images, which varied according to the size of what they were showing and how cluttered it was. So the extreme might be an empty warehouse, which is large and uncluttered, to something like a very messy cupboard in someone's home, which is small and complex.
Right.
And participants were shown all of these images for something less than a second, but they didn't know for how long they were shown. And they were asked to rate each image based on whether they felt they were shown it for a long period or a short period of time.
Right.
And they found that when they were viewing large and uncluttered images, like the empty warehouse, that they felt that, you know, that was super fast. Right. In other words, compared to when they were shown small and cluttered images, they felt like time slowed down. Right.
Which is, I would have thought the opposite. Yeah. I would have thought your brain would look at an empty space and go, yep, got it. And then I'm still looking at this. I've already seen what's in there. That takes a long time.
They were, which is odd. So they had a lot of time with it because they were looking at a lot of stuff in it and trying to see the complexity within it. That wasn't the only thing they found. So they also looked at memory effects. In other words, how much they could remember. They showed these volunteers 196 images that had been rated for their memorability using machine learning. Right. So some algorithm went off and looked at these machines or these photos and rated them for memorability. And they found that people experienced these time dilations again, in that there were for the ones that were deemed to be more memorable, right? They felt that they were spending longer on them, so that they were dwelling on them longer.
Look, I mean, I know if you're like really getting deep into neuroscience and psychology, this is an interesting finding. I can't really think of a practical application.
I can think of one.
Lecturing
slides that are too busy. I'm just thinking, or you know, if you're trying
but
to,
but you actually
know
you want slides that are busy, because yeah, they remember them longer.
But perhaps then people are like maybe they just feel like it's a longer time. You know, oh, that was such a long lecture.
It's oh, the there's end so of much term information for on those Susan slides. Maybe we're both looking at student evaluation and going, Susan spent too long on her lecture slides.
Maybe if you had an empty lecture hall, but I don't. Yeah. Of course, yeah. I'm sure yours are packed.
I won't even
ask. Our final story has to do with something that fascinates me always: taste.
Taste, yes. So we know that there are the five tastes that we can taste in our mouth, which is sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and then umami, which is that fishy, savory flavor. But what this research that came out this week in Nature is looking at the receptors that are on our tongue that will allow us to taste different things. And specifically, they're looking at the bitter taste receptor. So this came from the University of North Carolina, and they looked at a series of receptors called the TAS2 or 1-4. So basically, it stands for type 2 taste receptors 14. And these receptors interact with about 1,000 different compounds on our tongue, and they give us that sensation of that bitterness within our mouth. But these are really complex proteins that are on cells that are on our tongue. And there's not very much understood around how they interact with these flavour compounds. So the researchers did what's called cryo-SEM to look at these
That's
proteins.
Very cool.
And the protein, I really, really like cryo, because what this is, if you imagine wrapping, winding a piece of string around your finger, and then you have to take your finger away, what happens to that piece of string, right? It falls apart and falls aside. But what the cryo-SEM can do with proteins is it basically freezes that type of structure. So proteins are kind of like a ribbon that's wound up in a very specific shape and size, and things fit into that ribbon and into that shape depending on that shape and size. So cryo allows you to, if you take the finger analogy again, allows you to wind that string around your finger and then remove your finger, leaving the structure there, and then you can put your finger back inside the string. So by using cryo-SEM, which is basically like freezing the molecules in their fixed position, you can get a sense of what kinds of shape and size of the interactions of all the different chains of these protein molecules, and then what they look like, and then you can get a sense of what things can fit in there, what kinds of molecules can fit in there.
When you say fit, you mean like create a sensation in this particular case?
Yes, exactly. So it's like a docking station. It's like a small molecule will dock in that protein if there's a certain size and shape of a kind of a like a bump on the protein surface. So much like your finger can fit back in, but if you put your baby finger back into the rope that's frozen or the string that's frozen, it won't fit quite as well as maybe the finger that you fitted around in the first place. So this new protein, what they found with this cryo-SEM is that there's two specific places that things can dock and molecules can bind. And then those are attributed to the types of characteristics that bitter flavours have, which means bitter flavours stick to those really well, and then our brain knows that those things are bitter.
Right.
And if people have different types of those proteins where maybe the docking isn't as good, so if you think about your finger that fits into a certain size of a string that's frozen, a different finger, someone else's finger, like a ring, won't fit onto someone else's finger.
And so they'll perceive that taste slightly differently.
Exactly.
Okay. So trying to understand the mechanisms by which we start to experience the taste of bitterness. Really interesting. Dr. Susan Kelleher from the School of Chemical Sciences at DCU and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Thanks very much. Now, the idea of a scientific conference is to non-scientists, perhaps sometimes a little dull. But that could not be said for the Interstellar Symposium, because once every 2 years, scientists, engineers, space travel enthusiasts, and sci-fi fans meet up to discuss how to leave our solar system. science consultant and board member of the Interstellar Research Group, Joseph Meany, joins me now. They're the group that put on this conference. Welcome to the program, Joseph. At the beginning of this organization, it was sort of a sci-fi thing, right? People coming together to share their enthusiasm for science fiction, but it's become something different. Tell me a little bit about the origins of the IRG.
So IRG started out of a dinner club of science fiction fans in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, that started over actually a dinner club back around 2010 or so. These science fiction fans are the ones that grew up reading Asimov, Clark, Heinlein, that sort of stuff. But they also had interesting professional lives. So they were living all around the Oak Ridge, Tennessee area, and they happened to be professional scientists, engineers, things of that nature. And so a number of them got together in Aosta, Italy in 2011 for a more regular space conference there, right? They spoke about one possible way to bring the science fiction of their beloved childhoods into a real world discussion now that they knew a few things about space, right? So they held a meeting back in the States and officially incorporated as the Tennessee Valley Interstellar Workshop in 2014. And that was because they all lived together around the Oak Ridge, Chattanooga, Huntsville, Alabama areas called the Tennessee Valley in the United States. So when they put together their conferences, they really wanted to give it a blend of both a professional scientific conference and a science fiction convention. And so the origins of the Interstellar Symposium blend the social elements of the latter into the professional presentations of the former. And you get this really interesting blend of people coming together to not just allow space for a little bit of wild hair ideas, but it allows those wild hair ideas to be particularly grounded in reality, right? You're coming to the table with something that's foundationally based in real observable science that we know about using modern physics. Since then, the Interstellar Research Group has held symposia all over the United States and now internationally. We've expanded to Kansas and Arizona. In 2023, we held our first international symposium with McGill University in Quebec. So we've had a lot of interest from academic partners. And now, actually, in 2024, we have a special symposium going on. It's our first European interstellar symposium in collaboration with the University of Luxembourg and the Luxembourg Space Agency that'll be held in Luxembourg in December this year.
So I'd like to get into the science pretty quickly, because what is interesting about this is we're talking about something that is so far away from our technical ability. And if you're watching The Three-Body Problem on Netflix, which I have seen, it is very similar. There is a problem in that in which they are trying to figure out how to move at the speed of light, because currently the problem with getting out of our solar system and to another star, which of course is huge, because the stuff in between us, there isn't really much there. It's empty space, right? So we want to get to another star. The difficulties with that are what?
The difficulties are massive. They're absolutely massive. So the nearest star system, the Centauri star systems, are about 4.1 light years away, which means that if something were traveling at the speed of light, which as far as we understand right now is impossible, it would take over 4 years to get there. Now, traveling slower than the speed of light then therefore means it's going to take correspondingly as long. The most ambitious programs of late right now aiming to shoot out of the solar system are clocking speeds fractions of the speed of light. Significant fractions, like 25% the speed of light, but even those kinds of speeds means that the transit from our solar system to the Centauri solar systems are going to take at least 16 to 20 years. And that's a one-way transit. That doesn't even mean getting information back. And so if you're beaming information back at the speed of light and you have a transit time of about 20 years, you're talking roughly on the order of 25 years transit time to get any kind of fundamental information back.
So I didn't realize that we had gotten to that stage, because I knew theoretically there are some technologies, which we'll discuss in a second, that might get us there. But I thought we were still talking about 1,000 years to get anything to the next solar system. So 25 years, I mean, there are space programs that are still going from 25 years ago. The Voyager space programs, of course, still after 30 years odd, are still transmitting signals back to us being very far away. Now, they're going much, much slower, of course. So at this conference, it's interesting because it's a blend of sci-fi ideas, but as you say, the stuff that gets presented must be grounded in our understanding of physics and science. And so what is this 25% speed of light idea? Like, how could we send something that can travel that fast?
Right. So when I say that we can send something, I'm not saying that we're going to be able to send humans. That's off the table for the moment. You know, we talk about that sort of in hypotheticals, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But when we're talking about these missions that are going 25% the speed of light, we're talking about something that weighs about as much as 2 sugar cubes. So we're talking about a gram's worth of material. And we're still talking about a considerable amount of energy being dumped into propelling this thing. And so the idea behind Breakthrough Starshot, which is funding most of this developmental work, are developing what are chipsats that weigh these sugar cubes, and they would be propelled by arrays of high-powered lasers that would accelerate these crafts very, very fast. So 25% the speed of light to get out of the solar system and cruise at a velocity towards the next star system. And from there, do a flyby mission. So we're not talking about slowing down. We're not talking about, you know, changing any kind of speed. Like, once they're up to speed, they're just zipping along.
Yeah. And there's no way of controlling it either. It's all pre-programmed, because if it takes 4 years or 5 years for light to get back from the system, that means it's 10 years for us to get anything back from it, to send and receive. So once we send it, it's just on its own. But do we have that sort of technology yet?
So the science is almost there in a lot of different arenas.
Okay.
It's not been flight tested yet, so...
But the theory is there.
There's still... The theory is there. There's scientists in California working on things called metamaterials that are highly reflective materials that allow the laser sails to work really well. There's people that are putting together the actual laser power systems so that they could be sat atop mountains, I believe in Chile, so that you have this really high power exit laser that would hit this
begin that process. So that's one, obviously one thing that people present on this symposium on, but they also present on lots of other things. You talked about humans traveling these sort of distances potentially to the next star. What are the best working theories that we have to actually get humans? We're talking about generational ships, right?
Yeah. So any travel with humans right now is going to be much slower. We don't have the tech. We don't have the wherewithal to postulate that humans are going to be traveling anywhere near the, you know, 0.25 times the speed of light or anything like that. And so we're talking about human health in space. Those topics are coming together. It's like, how do we build structural resilient societies? How do we increase access for the disabled and uniquely abled individuals? Space habitats are really strong. But then we're also talking about what is the medical understanding that would, for example, allow deep hibernation and allow for humans to make the transit while slowing down metabolism. So there's a company, Spaceworks Limited, that is working on that in sort of the background down in Atlanta, Georgia.
And so the people,
so we have all sorts of different options.
The people who are working on this stuff and presenting it at the IRG conferences, are they doing it for fun, or do they feel like there's a practical application for this, or that they are starting a journey that others will continue, that is the progress generally of science, that, you know, people will stand on their shoulders, so to speak, and that we might actually end up using some of these ideas or some of these technologies to reach a star in 30, 40, 50 years time?
Well, personal motivations are as varied as the people that come out, right? So Michelle Hanlon of For All Moonkind is working on things like space law to establish the first baby steps for us to be able to even operate in a legal environment out in outer space, because there's not a strong framework out there for, you know, contracting liability and things of that nature. But a lot of these folks are academics. So they're either funded by government research grants, but there's also a lot of philanthropy out there. So the organization Breakthrough Starshot is part of the larger Breakthrough Prize Foundation, and that's funded through philanthropic dollars. So people are funded to do this research partly because they love it, but also partly because it's good for their careers. And so these are people that are academics typically, but not always, so that we do have plenty of companies coming in that are spending parts of their research and development dollars on high risk, high reward types of problems, because they feel that they have something to positively contribute to the human experience, because all of that technology is going to trickle down to our day-to-day lives anyway. And that's always been true of space research, is it's always been about thinking big to translate back to Earth.
What about the science fiction landscape? Have there been any programs that you've seen that have mirrored or borrowed or reflected the real life research? Because some of the stuff seems really out there. So in Three Body Problem, for example, and I don't want to ruin anything for anyone, but there's this concept of sending a brain, like a living brain, because it's much lighter than a human being. And they were like, we can only send maybe a kilo. And so that was the idea, to send a human brain. Programs out there that are really, really quite close to where we are technologically that you can think of? And when you see people presenting at the workshop, do you ever find yourself going, whoa, this is very, very different and actually quite promising?
Yeah, I mean, The Expanse is kind of hailed amongst our crowd as part of the best of the best of realistic science fiction as far as what we're expecting within interplanetary travel, right? You've got to deal with resource management in the different habitats, and you've got to understand the different chemical flows and manufacturing issues that are all going on with this. And in fact, the IRG has a book series coming out that is summing up a lot of, you know, this work. It's a three-part book series that's coming out, an academic book series published by Elsevier called Interstellar Travel.
Wow.
The first book was released in 2023 called Interstellar Travel, Purpose and Motivations. Book two is coming out, I believe, next month. It's hot off the presses. That's Interstellar Travel, Propulsion, Life Support, Communications, and the Long Journey. And then book three will come out late this year or early 2025, and that's Interstellar Travel After Arrival. And so that's bringing together all these experts in the field to talk about and review where the state of the art is in all of these different aspects of interstellar travel.
One of the dangers of this sort of research is, of course, that military arms of governments across the world might find a way to hijack some of the technology or some of the ideas in it. Have you found that there is a strong military presence at any of the conferences? Is there interest from governments in the sort of information and lectures that are being given at the conferences?
I would say strong, no. Is it present? Yes. We've had government officials at the IRG symposia in the past. And now that America has its Space Force, there are a couple of members that show up and contribute each year. But that's going to be true, certainly, of any of these technologies that they would get developed for nefarious dual-use purposes. The Interstellar Research Group advocates only peaceful use of this, and that's why we want to work in with the space law component. But we also understand that given our group's nature in that we're trying to bring all of humanity together, that's going to contain a governance aspect, and we need to be cognizant and careful of that as we go forward. But it's going to require cooperation, and that's why we're really excited to have worked with Canada previously. We're excited to work with Luxembourg this year. And if there's any Irish space organizations out there, you know, please be in touch. Maybe 2027 can be on the Emerald Isle.
I would love that. And I would definitely be there. Really interesting to speak with you. And I think we might be in touch again when that book comes out. Thank you so much for joining us. Joseph Meaney is from the Interstellar Research Group. Thanks, Joseph.
Yeah, thank you.
That whole idea of thinking about how we get to another star, it's a really intoxicating one for me as a concept. The idea that, you know, as humans, you know, that we would live on some sort of generational ship with artificial gravity. Like, obviously, it is the stuff of many, many science fiction programs and books. But it's still a very exotic one to me, you know. I think it's of all the science fiction concepts, the idea that we might create generational ships to go to a different star system is so cool. Love to get your thoughts on that. You can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also tweet us. We're at Newstalk Science. Looking back now at some of your comments from last week's program, Aidan McKelvey joins me in studio, producer of the program.
Hello.
We were speaking to Philip Goff. About the purpose of the universe. And this interview got a little bit heated, if you listen back, because I was getting a little bit frustrated. And in fairness to Philip, I probably wasn't fully listening to everything he was saying.
I was just going,
this is, well, I personally, you look out on Twitter and on social media, and you just see there's so many people trying to insert magic into places and also using magic to be really horrible. Unless you can show me it, I'm not allowing it in. So, well, you know, if that's purpose of a universe, which is what Philip was talking about, he was saying that the universe, you know, the likelihood of us being where we are is so unlikely that perhaps we can see in the mathematics some sense of a purpose of the universe. There is a reason. And we didn't get into too much detail of it because I pretty much barked at him then for the rest of it going, no magic stuff, no thank you. Do you follow that Twitter account, Christian Nightmares?
I do not.
It's a guy who just retweets like content, mostly from United States of America, of, you know, preachers and, you know, these TikTokers who are evangelical and the stuff they say and do. And it is so horrible. I mean, I'm really horrified and I'm really scared by it.
Yeah, I shudder to think what they say.
It's on Twitter, Christian Nightmares. I mean, look, as someone who really doesn't believe in anything magical, I can't prove there isn't a God, right? There isn't a God, right? That's impossible. But, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be very likely. And the zealousness, the zeal with which these people sort of, you know, say, you know, Jesus is coming again and the chosen people are going to go up to God and like all this sort of stuff. It's just so bonkers to me. And it kind of scares me that when someone says, look, the mathematics say, look, this, we gotta at least think about there might be a possibility here. I'm like, I don't think about nothing. So that's what happened. And I kind of barked over him a bit. Dr. Renee Blow tweets, she says, I love listening to this. You asked great questions and Goff gave great answers. I laughed at the point where you asked why we couldn't just be a fluke of physics. As I said to an applied physicist the other day, you can't explain arrogance by the laws of physics. Very good, Renee. Another says, the evidence suggests what the observer recognizes. The problem that Philip Goff has to address is that philosophical zombies give evidence of purpose, yet by definition have none. How then does one distinguish between zombie and non-zombie? Is it just what we want to see? That is a good question. And I think it reminds me of that question of Turing. You know, if a robot sounds like a robot, feels like a robot, then it's obviously a robot. But if you're talking to a machine and it feels fully human, what is the actual difference? Ruriok says, I think Philip got me on board insofar as we should look at different hypotheses when understanding the universe, although I didn't hear how the universe has purpose. My problem is, right, the mathematics that we have, there's the mathematics we have right now. And I do think, you know, talking about how unlikely this happening is, that doesn't seem to make sense as a concept. Like saying, oh, the mathematics of this happening, if the universe is infinite, this is, you know, if we say the universe is infinite, which I agree is a crazy concept, right? But as we look out into the sky, that's all we see. We see, you know, I mean, there is reasonable evidence for infinity, or at least a really, 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 really enormous universe, right? And if that exists, then life must be an inevitability in some way. I mean, like, I don't know. The idea that everything that happened, that all these things worked out, and it's so unlikely, I just don't buy it. And also, we've only just seen us. I mean, there could be loads of life in the universe. We just don't have the tools to see it. So maybe actually loads of random stuff could happen, and it has happened all over the universe, and it's going to happen.
But he didn't say it was just about us, though, in fairness. And I get what you're saying. It's a sample size of one. You have one universe to check, and this universe seems to be this way. But he was saying, it didn't have to be us. He was saying that it's just the way it's set up is predisposed for the end goal of it to be life.
But you would say that if you were living, though. I mean, if there was no life, no, there'd be no one there to say it.
No, I mean that's true. But he was saying that there, because of the way. So he mentioned like various kind of laws or principles we have in the universe currently. Just the tweaking of them a tiny bit would have made life totally and would have made life, stars, everything else totally and utterly impossible. So I guess he's asking that question of why did it have to be that way.
And I suppose, but isn't that the truth of evolution as well? And there isn't the woodpecker didn't evolve this ability to peck wood consciously. It happened through natural selection. And so that's the way it is. So isn't that the way of the universe, that things happened and it went out that way? And if you wind it back and say, how could it? I mean, it's like God people who say, oh, the woodpecker, look how it does this, and it's this amazing niche, or how could an alligator swim underwater and have its nose above, you know, all these things. They say this is obviously design, when actually it's just fluke refined.
Yeah, but I mean, South Park actually have a very good line on this, when there's a big debate, I can't remember what episode it is, between religious people and non-religious people, and I think Kyle says, why can't evolution be the answer to how rather than the answer to why? So you can have a God and you can have evolution.
Do you want to continue producing this program?
Well, like, I'm agnostic. You're atheist. So I'm being totally scientific about it. I'm standing on the fence.
Right. Okay. Hi, Jonathan. I just listened to the podcast with Professor Goff on the universe having a purpose. It was a really interesting piece, which I enjoyed, although please try to avoid talking over the guests. I do, for the most part, in fairness.
He does.
I do. You've probably come across Nick Bostrom of Oxford University's simulation hypothesis, in which he argues that the most likely scenario is that we all live in a computer simulation where some advanced race is attempting to simulate a universe for their own purposes, perhaps for scientific research or even just as a computer game. Maybe God is just a spotty teenager playing computer games in his mum's basement. I think you covered this in the show in the past. I often thought this theory was interesting when thinking about quantum mechanics. So many things in quantum mechanics aren't determined until an observer observes something. In other words, the position, or for example, the position of an electron. This is exactly what a computer programmer would do when faced with lots of calculations and limited processing power. They wouldn't bother doing the calculations unless they absolutely became necessary when you looked at them, and instead used averages that worked well enough when nobody was looking. Just like in quantum mechanics, the electron works quite fine without a determined position, and it only needs a specific position when an observer looks to see what it is. Perhaps the answer to Professor Goff's explanation that the universe has a purpose is that because the simulation hypothesis is correct and we are just living in a simulation, the reason that the variables of this universe are so finely tuned is because someone programmed them that way to have an interesting simulation. Thanks very much for the continued high content. Been a listener since the beginning. Love the show. Thanks very much for that, Colin. I mean, it is, again, it's like, yeah, absolutely. And maybe that, but maybe, you know, maybe the world is a giant banana. Yeah. You know, like, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's, oh, that banana comment is fair. You're never going to hear me say that again. No, I have, there's two things that I find interesting about that. The simulation thing, I think it just kicks the can down the road, though, because then, like, who made them? Are they also a simulation? And it's simulation.
Turtles on the back of turtles.
But can I tell you a little story about when I was a computer game tester?
Go.
I used to, for a while...
I never had you as a gamer.
No, I wasn't really a gamer. I did every job under the sun when I was a musician.
Right,
and
okay.
That could make me money. But we were working on one of the Final Fantasy games.
Oh, yeah.
And my job was to test the language. So you would go to into a village and you'd ask, like, the barber some question and he'd have a set answer. Well, you should go to the castle or whatever. you know how these games go.
Yeah.
But what I would do is, like, I was, like, their best tester because I was pedantic about it. So I'd go into him, the barber, ask him the question, come back out, go back in again. He'd say something else like, yes, you should go to the castle. But by about the fourth or fifth time you went back in, he'd just say some mad gibberish and you had found your fault in the game. Because like in the simulation there, he'd only be programmed with the idea that he'll do enough that if you come in once and ask the question, he can answer the question. If you go in four times, he just falls apart.
Which is kind of strange because you think in some way you are saving him the work of having to learn a whole load of a script. But in the other way, from a programming point of view, why don't you just give him those responses and nothing else? It's kind of crazy. Why did Jonathan get so heated during the discussion with Philip Goff? He was almost argumentative at one point. Poor Philip, says Daniel Hatton from Ivy Leagues. Daniel, do you know what? Why not? Why not get heated? Why not have an old Barney every once in a while? I mean, it's very rare. And I don't think I was rude. I was bordering it, but I don't think it was rude. We had an email in from Tom Evans about near-death experiences and induction hobs. Remember this? And Tom said, my heart went a bit funny and I was leaning over a hob and I didn't realise that there was danger and whatever. And I was like,
it went more than a bit funny. He had a heart attack.
I mean, he didn't say that gave him the heart, but he said it could have been. There's some sort of link.
Yeah.
And so Andy Heard has emailed us in. He says, hi, everyone. I just want to follow up on the remark made by your correspondent who linked proximity to an induction cooker with a cardiac arrest. Although you were rightly doubtful of cause and effect, our research group at Imperial College investigated experimentally how radio waves might affect human heart rhythm 10 to 15 years ago. The subjects were human volunteers and we were studying the effect of tetra radios. These are devices used by the emergency services and have about the same power output as a mobile phone. The result was small changes in heart rate variability consistent with vagal nerve stimulation. The effect was tiny, less than the impact of opening and closing your eyes, but an induction cooker, I'm guessing, might be generating a stronger field intensity than a handheld radio. There's a non-technical description of what we did at police-health.org.uk/40. Thanks very much for that, Andy. Very interesting. But I guess for me as a broadcaster, you kind of go, look, don't be worrying about your induction hob. That's safe. You know, it's not going to give you a heart attack. I think.
Yeah, you imagine these things have been tested.
Yeah, you'd hope.
You'd imagine, yeah.
You'd hope. But then that Tesla, you know, accelerator pedal looks kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go. That's it from us on this week's podcast. Thanks to producer Aidan McCovey and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.